Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Yesterday, September 11th, was the 23rd anniversary of what has simply been known since as 9/11, the day the USA was attacked at its nerve center by latter-day kamikazes from the middle rather than the far east. 9/11 is an emergency call. Someone is in desperate need of help. Since 2001, 9/11 is also a date in the American calendar of mass terrorism and death, an unforgettable shock of watching through television lenses of people jumping to their deaths off skyscraping buildings because there was no other way of escaping the flames of wrath from the impact of two torpedoing jetliners. I start today's program with a page one tirade I wrote about 9/11 at the time in my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle. The worst day. September 11th has turned the world upside down, which was the name of a popular song the British Army played on its fifes and drums as it marched out of Yorktown, Virginia, after losing the American Revolution to colonial rebels and terrorists in October 1781. The devastating and unprecedented fanatical suicide attacks that destroyed the World Trade Center in New York City and severely damaged the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., at a catastrophic cost in lives on September 11th, were not directed at those installations merely because they are symbols of American power, but are truly the centers of this nation's military and economic New World Order. The appalling attack on the USA claims the worst death toll on a single day in American history. Nearly 6,000 persons, double that of the Civil War's Antietam battle, which was the worst previous day of death and unprecedented since the burning of Washington, D.C. during the War of 1812, when the British attempted a comeback. Similar to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the devastating murder-suicide strike on the WTC and the Pentagon burst our personal bubbles. Suddenly, we as individuals are minuscule, our private concerns petty and irrelevant. Although we think of other things, it dominates our minds each time 9/11 comes around on the calendar, underlying our thoughts, hopes, and perceptions, and will for a long time yet. We have wrung out our brains and souls over this. Nothing else seems worth thinking about until this horror that haunts us is resolved, and we suspect it may never be resolved despite attempts at retribution. Bombing Afghanistan back to a Stone Age, it seems to have never been allowed to emerge from, is not the panache or the panacea that will help us recover from our national angst. The funerals and memorial services will continue, yet the collective sense of having been raped might persist the rest of our individual lives and will most likely be a legacy of our unborn heirs. The McDisney images of this new century millennium are revealed as the insipid fantasies they really were. It is a drastically different world we now perceive for the future, yet it is the same old world of danger and death it has always been, never mind for how long we have been able to pretend it is not. Our center of gravity has radically shifted, and we look out upon a newer milieu of uncertainty with feelings of anxiety, dread, and grim determination to survive that would be familiar to our earliest ancestors. The nation is, as one person said, awash in patriotism, defiance, compassion, and fear. It is especially a time, as Rudyard Kipling said in a famous poem, to keep our heads when all others seem to be losing theirs. The only thing that gives any and all of us a chance in this sorry world is the right and freedom to express our opinions and beliefs, to weigh in on national crises. As gruesome and immensely tragic as September 11th was, and the agony of its imprint on the American psyche, there is a grievous danger in overinflating the disaster to justify curtailing the Bill of Rights in the name of national security. The basic principles of our nation might well be suspended. Television, which is unable to resist hype and hyperbole, even amidst national tragedy, would have us think its panorama of patriotic ceremonies, the usual talking heads speculating military strategies and responses, and the countless camera views of flag-carrying Americans verifies that the entire nation demands vengeance and war. Yet a passionate and significant debate is being carried out all across the USA concerning the future we collectively face, and it is reflected in internet email and in the columns and letters pages of newspapers. Many writers wish revenge and say we must have the stomach to kill innocent persons, so-called collateral casualties, to get at terrorists. Many others place security over liberty. Others give the president carte blanche in what he touts as the first war of the 21st century. But nearly half caution patience and reason rather than vengeance and military action. The forum inadvertently addresses the dilemma of a modern superpower. What does a colossus do when attacked by ferocious mice? The attempt by our former worldophobic leaders to unite the world as allies against terrorism might seem cynically self-serving in the small picture, but a very good idea in the larger sense. We are a global civilization after all. The larger projection is that the United Nations represents this global civilization. As raucous and contentious as it is, but does not yet have the power to protect Americans or anyone else. Yet this is a chance to apply international law and courts to terrorism and the crimes against humanity its adherents perpetrate. The United Nations should act as arbiter of the Terrorist Act committed in this country, as Franklin Roosevelt intended it to be, to reverse the failure of the League of Nations to prevent global war. The president should present the evidence he claims to have against Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network, and that UN hearings as well as trial in the World Court be the dominant aim rather than a perpetual war on terrorism. Fighting terrorism is a lot like stamping out fires with your feet. They spring back up again and again, their flames scattered by the stamping, but most especially from fires underground that burn over great distances and erupt in several directions. Although we regard whoever attacked the home country as cowardly terrorists, they undoubtedly consider themselves heroic Davids standing up against the gigantic juggernaut of Goliath to revenge contemporary and historical grievances. They struck not only at the centers of U.S. economic and military power, they were also striking at our ambitions to be the heart of Western-dominated world civilization. The terrorists are called evil, and they respond by calling the USA the Great Satan. So we have two warring sides who claim God and right on their side, one with an arsenal capable of atomizing the world to oblivion, the other armed with comparatively inferior weapons, yet with imaginatively destructive intentions of their use that are defined euphemistically as low-density warfare. They have shown themselves able to attack anywhere in the world with passionate fury and calculating homicidal suicide. Human civilization is on the brink of something dire and awesome. It stares into a vortex that might very well obliterate it. Already the possibility of World War III is invoked, the final conflict predicted for millennia and possibly encouraged by millenarians. Palestine, Israel, is the focal point of the vortex. It is where two very different peoples clash over ancestral land, each disputably claims indisputably, which exacerbates every other conflict in Islam and might be the real prophesied Armageddon. For the USA and Europe, Israel is the brave outpost of Judaism, struggling to sustain its recaptured biblical promised land, Zion, also synonymous with heaven and Jerusalem. To the Arab peoples, it is an upstart intrusion that usurped ancient Arab lands and cultures that once tolerated Judaism but loathes modern zealous Zionism that has disinherited them. This small splinter of Mediterranean desert between West and East has been the focal point of history since the savage anti-Semitic pogroms of Europe precipitated the Zionist movement to recreate a Jewish homeland in Palestine their ancestors had to flee in the infamous diaspora of Roman times. Except another people of another ancient religious culture were living in Palestine, and for them it was their ancestral homeland also, and among them were Jews. These people were not isolated from the rest of humanity, as had been the indigenous American peoples who were ultimately deprived of their lands and nearly exterminated by a three-century war of genocide. Defending the Palestinians culturally and territorially is the rest of Islam. This is the root of the problem that prevents a truly world civilization, which has been a long-held dream, at least for dreamers, philosophers, and humanitarians, weary of the interminable wars between tribes, cultures, religions, and nations. Here is the seemingly unresolvable problem that threatens humanity with possible annihilation. Here, the best and worst traits of humanity are evident on both sides and clash head-on. Would a United Nations redistributing of Palestine, Israel, work to settle the problem acceptable to both East and West? Will Jews and Palestinians give up religious nationalism for the sake of sharing a dual homeland? Would a few generations eventually heal the rift that has existed for more than 1,000 years between three of the world's significant religions? Or is it hopelessly mired in the irredeemable past and thus patently self-destructs the human future? The earlier analogy of firefighting might be applicable. If you can't put out or control a fire, attempt at least to contain it each time it erupts from a low flame. But this fire has been burning for millennia in one form or another, and each time it flares, its consequences are worse than ever. It would be a grotesque irony that humanity perishes because it is unable to resolve the conflicts from its earliest history. Perhaps after the war is finished, whenever and if ever, and the shock of its costs and repercussions numb the current rally around the flag frenzy, many more American citizens might wish they had been more sympathetic to voices of dissent they this moment spurn or even denounce. How empty, how sickish, how senseless everything suddenly seems when a war is over, Edmund Wilson once wrote. Pacifists, people who wish to live not only their own lives in peace, but wish for it to become the normal condition of humanity, are sneered at in times of war fervor and are told to live in the real world. Yet the real world, the human world, is of our making and threatens more than ever to be our undoing. Pacifists usually look down the long road instead of being gripped with the frenzies of the moment, although these can drive one to despair. And they have grim visions of humanity's future if it continues to make war upon itself on a small, already overcrowded planet on which the infection of violence and intolerance can spread faster than other diseases and is the catalyst for most of the rest. True, the human species will probably die out someday, just as we individually look into the future and see our own corpses laying somewhere on the timeline, or it might evolve beyond anything recognizable as human. Pacifists seem to hope we might at least elevate to a higher plane of thought and compassion before we blow ourselves out like an extinguished candle. Think of George Orwell. War is peace. And that was The Worst Day, which I wrote for my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, just after 9/11. And I'd like to continue the theme with something I wrote for the same paper a year later. And I start with the quote of a young daughter of a U.S. airline pilot. I play with my dolls, and I think of Bin Laden. My dolls save the world sometimes, and sometimes they save the people in the towers and the airplanes. And by Marshall de Saxe, from his Reveries of the Art of War, he wrote in 1732, "The human heart is the start of all matters pertaining to war." The mental images of the captive passenger-filled suicide airliners crashing into both towers of the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, are indelible in the American psyche. As familiar and cryptic as the smoking ribbons of the Challenger space shuttle. Although Pearl Harbor has been remembered all over again since 9/11, the images of the first day of infamy seem ancient history. Other images recalled 9/11. Thousands of hands reaching up as if to stop the collapsing South Tower of the World Trade Center. Falling bodies of people who jumped to their deaths to escape the fires started by the jets, in particular a couple holding hands as they fell. Doomed firemen going up into the towers, passing fleeing survivors going down. The wreckage of a fourth skyjacked airliner forced to crash in Pennsylvania woods, short of its probable target in Washington, D.C., by passengers who seemed aware everyone aboard were about to die regardless of their resistance. A few obscure images, seldom recalled or even noticed, are yet revealing and prophetic. Two crowds confronted each other in Chicago on the night of 9/11. One group, white and right, the other mostly brown and Muslim, shouting at each other, "USA, USA, USA." A young man on a bicycle in D.C., 9/11 morning, just after the third plane kamikaze the Pentagon, shouted the attacks on it and the World Trade Center were appropriate punishment for the USA's oppressive foreign policy, and was pelted with food and rocks by a shocked and angry crowd. Police searched his clothes and knapsack for explosives, then allowed him to ride away, exchanging shouts with people on the sidewalk. A woman in Chicago the same day cryptically said 9/11 was phase one. A woman on 9/11 morning in New York City described a surreal atmosphere of people standing on street corners, staring up at the flaring towers, and after they collapsed, seemed to numbly look at the subsequent pile of rubble that was vast and several stories high. Another woman said she saw crowds of people walking away from ground zero, stunned after the towers collapsed. "Where are you going?" she asked. "Away," they said. A woman who used to live in Astoria and lives now across the East River from the WTC saw the towers burst into smoke and flame from a picture window in her apartment high above the street and regretted she could not shut off the view like a television, yet she did not close the curtains. Pearl Harbor was an analogy of the day for 9/11. Complete surprise, a direct hit on the USA's symbols of wealth and power, epic destruction. The anger and instant desire for revenge were about the same as Pearl Harbor. Also, the heart-wrenching sense of tragedy and the immediate finger-pointing at why 9/11 was allowed to happen. Suspicion of government foreknowledge of 9/11 was also a Pearl Harbor legacy. There are questions about 9/11. The most extreme claim is that it was planned and set in motion at the highest echelons of the U.S. government, or at least these upper cadres knew about the terrorists' intentions and did nothing to prevent the attack. Nixon's smoking gun rideau. What did the president know, and when did he know it? With a conundrum, what has he gained from it? After World War II, self-proclaimed isolationists charged that President Franklin Roosevelt trapped, and that's a quote, the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor in order to get around the constitutional requirement for a declaration of war, which became the basis for an incessant quarrel that persists into this new millennium and quantumly affects controversy over 9/11. There certainly was gross low-level negligence in the intelligence community in both the Pearl Harbor and 9/11 attacks, as well as high-level laxity in the White House, short of downright conspiracy. And like FDR in his personal war with Adolf Hitler even before Pearl Harbor, President George W. Bush demanded wartime prerogatives of a president without the aforementioned declaration of war, playing with the old don't change horses in midstream gambit that successfully gave Roosevelt his third and fourth terms. A significant difference from Pearl Harbor, despite the instant nationwide flowering of flags, including flag-patterned clothing and accessories of the sort that got Abbie Hoffman arrested a generation ago, and a profusion of Stars and Stripes collectibles, is that the nation was not as immediately or undividedly united as the historic claim after Pearl Harbor and as the country's war leaders had intended us to believe since 9/11. The nation's real unity was its shock and revulsion at 9/11. But from there, a growing split intensified as to the real motives of the attack, as well as who was involved beside the suiciders and the nature of reaction to it. The 9/11 attack on the USA was most definitely a crime against humanity and a violation of international law because it specifically targeted civilians, which is essentially why U.S. apologists were hasty after initially denying to ensure that every civilian casualty from U.S. bombing or other military action since 9/11 is purely accidental and quite simply a consequence of war rather than premeditated murder. But just as surely as innocents are killed in war, the devastating and unprecedented attack on 9/11 was not directed at the WTC and Pentagon, and perhaps the White House, as mere symbols of American power, but instead as the true center of the USA's political, economic, and militarily global supremacy. That was clearly the perspective of those who elaborately planned and executed the attacks. They regarded those employed in those two centers, and surely the White House, as directly responsible for American actions around the world, as are U.S. soldiers, diplomats, and multinational corporations based in the USA. Total war is not the only prerogative of military institutions, but also of those who struggle against them by any means at hand, however horrible and catastrophic the results. In a total war, everybody is a soldier, which was the ultimate rationale of the mass bombings of cities in World War II, and certainly the use of two atomic bombs in Japanese cities, which ushered in the nuclear age and its iconic mushroom cloud that has billowed over nearly everything since. Those who committed the atrocity of 9/11 did not do it because they are evil, but because they perceived evil had been done to them, and they reciprocated as they were capable. A major reaction of the USA to 9/11 was that it is irrelevant what we have done to others. All that matters is what has been done to us, which is dealt with as if it occurred in a vacuum. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. Donald Trump is a prime reason the USA is a democracy and that we common citizens have the obligation to keep it so. Trump seems to think Americans want him to be a Hitleresque dictator, and after he is voted back into the presidency, he would suspend electoral governance and imprison his enemies. Trump had his opportunity to strut his stuff as president of the USA, and he failed miserably, demonstrating that he is the worst sort of leader, not so much a fierce fascist, but a fatuous fathead who seems to insist he is a proper dictator whom we the people truly need and desire to have as our Caesar. He had his chance and demonstrated that he is a wretched, blundering, despotic dolt. A notorious draft dodger whose imperious and cowardly avoidance of the Vietnam War, Trump's recent attempt to disgrace the honored dead at Arlington, was a stark revelation of his contempt for liberty and the eternal pursuit of equality. That public disregard of sacrifice might just have truly trumped Trump.